watching, but I couldn't even do that.
May I see the ring? Asked Ellen.
It's an antique, said Patrick. It's got a history. Someone else's history, I mean. It's not like it's from my own family, but I thought you'd like that.
He opened the box and flipped it shut again without looking at it.
I didn't think you were the type for one of those standard shiny diamond rings. Jack helped me choose it.
He was talking sadly and nostalgically, as if about something that had happened a long time in the past.
It sounds perfect, said Ellen. So could I...
He pushed the ring across the table to her and she opened the box.
Oh, Patrick.
The ring was white gold with a small oval aquamarine stone the color of the ocean.
It's beautiful. It's exactly what I would have chosen for myself.
Ellen had never been especially interested in jewelry. She was not one of those women who could speak authoritatively about carats or cuts. Ooh, sparkly, she would say when newly engaged friends drooped their left hands at her. To her, their rings all looked identical.
But the absolute rightness of Patrick's choice made her want to cry. It was like tangible evidence that he really saw her. It was a ring she could never have envisaged or described, but one that said, "Didn't you know? This is who you are."
Ellen regretfully closed the lid, unsure what to do next. She hadn't actually said yes to his proposal yet. For the first time since she'd heard about Saskia's existence, she felt a satisfying, righteous flash of rage. That moment had been hers. Right now, she was meant to be doing that half-sobbing, half-laughing thing that women did, burying her head in Patrick's chest, stopping every now and then to hold up her hand and examine her ring. It was meant to be a memory to cherish, and now it was gone forever.
It was probably too soon to ask you, said Patrick. But it just felt so right, and I thought, to hell with it. I know she's the one, so I...
He stopped and blinked slowly, like one of her clients coming out of a trance. Did you say you were pregnant?
So, he's going to be the hypnotist's husband. He was doing the whole movie scene deal, the pink sky, sunset, the champagne, the bended knee. I thought, they're actually going to live that life. See, it really does happen to some people. They're going to have a beautiful, elegant wedding, probably on the beach, and it won't rain. But if it does, it'll be funny. The men will hold up big umbrellas and the women will giggle and run in their high heels. She'll only have one glass of champagne because she's pregnant. And then the baby will be born and everyone will gather in the hospital room with flowers and jokes and cameras. Then they'll have another baby, the opposite sex of the first one. They'll have dinner parties with friends and such busy weekends. And they'll brush away sentimental tears at their children's concerts. And when the kids are older, they'll travel and take up hobbies and eventually move into a friendly retirement village. And when they die, their children and grandchildren will gather around and mourn them. Who would mourn for me if I died today? My colleagues? I think they'd get over it pretty fast and then they'd be fighting for my office. Friends? In the space of a few years, I've got myself crossed off everyone's Christmas card list. It was my fault. I couldn't be bothered. I never return their calls or answer their emails. I was too busy following Patrick. It's quite a time-consuming hobby. My hairdresser seems fond of me, but who would tell her that I'd died? She'd just think I'd left her for another hairdresser, which I would never do. Maybe I should leave a note. In the event of my death, please let my hairdresser know. There will be no grief or pain for the hypnotist and her husband, and if there is, it will always pass. They'll support each other until they're over it. The doctor will give them prescriptions to fix the pain. It's strange, but now that this has happened, I find I can no longer imagine getting back together with Patrick. Something has changed. He never proposed to me. We never even talked about it. He'd already had the big white wedding with Colleen. I spent ages looking through the huge leather-bound rectangle of a photo album, staring at Colleen in her big white poofy-sleeved dress, wondering what she would have thought of me. One morning, when we were lying in bed, Patrick said, out of the blue, "I'm keeping you forever." And that was all I needed. That was my romantic proposal and engagement ring and wedding ceremony and honeymoon all in one. As far as I was concerned, we were married from that moment. But obviously not as far as Patrick was concerned.
Ellen is the sort of woman who makes a man feel the urge to go down on one knee and propose, whereas I am not. When I walked over to them at that picnic table, I felt like some sort of hideous half-human creature. I could smell my own ugliness. I accept it. It's fine. They will be forever on the inside, and I will forever be on the outside. But I will make sure they always know I'm still there, looking in, peering through the glass, tapping on the window. I will never go away.
She'll never go away, said Patrick. If you marry me, you'll have to accept that she's part of the package. My son, my mum, my dad, my brother, my stalker.
Yes, said Ellen. I understand.
I hope it's a girl, said Patrick. The baby. I hope it's a little girl. I'd love a beautiful little girl. Would you like a little baby girl?
Sure, said Ellen. Patrick wasn't drunk, but his words were softening around the edges. They were sitting on the balcony of their hotel room, and he was drinking the rest of the champagne. It appeared they were engaged. Ellen was wearing the ring on her left hand. It kept catching her eye. She had said yes. Patrick was thrilled about the baby, ecstatic even. When the news of her pregnancy had finally sunk in, he pulled her into his arms and held her like she was something precious. A baby, he murmured. Bloody hell, who cares about anything else? We're having a baby. Everything was perfect, except that Saskia's face seemed to be permanently floating on the peripheral of Ellen's vision, like the shocking memory of a bad car accident, the crunch of metal, the flinging back of the head. She kept replaying that moment when Saskia walked toward them, the wide, friendly smile, the eyes made blank by her dark sunglasses. Ellen's righteous fury had abated, and now she felt strangely spent, empty of feeling, as though she really had been in some sort of traumatic accident.
It's weird, but I didn't feel as angry as I usually do when Saskia turned up today, said Patrick. I just felt this calmness, a sort of acceptance.
So her post-hypnotic suggestion had worked a treat. Ellen felt both professional pride and professional guilt. She said nothing. Her back ached. She wriggled around in her chair, trying to get comfortable, and fiddled with the ring.
Is it too tight? Asked Patrick, watching her. We can change the size.
It's perfect, said Ellen. I'm just not used to wearing rings. Patrick emptied the rest of the champagne into his glass and settled back into his chair, stretching his legs out and entwining his toes around the bars of the balcony fence.
Yes. A beautiful, blonde-haired little girl who looks just like you, he said happily, looking out at the moonlit night.
Except I don't have blonde hair, Ellen laughed.
Of course you don't.
Patrick rolled his eyes at his own stupidity and reached out to lightly touch his hand against Ellen's hair.
I think I was imagining her looking like Jack.
Ellen thought of the photo she'd seen at his parents' place of Colleen sitting on the hospital bed holding Jack. Her hair, she remembered, was long, wavy, and very blonde. When they got back to Sydney, they told all and sundry about the engagement, and just their closest friends and family about the, pregnancy. People seemed surprisingly happy for them. They got tears in their eyes. They sent flowers and cards. They turned up with bottles of champagne and flamboyant hugs.
Why do you find it surprising? Asked Patrick.
I don't know, said Ellen. I guess I didn't think anyone would care that much at our age.
They're just happy to hear some good news for a change, said Patrick. People love happy endings.
For some reason, Ellen didn't really like all the fuss and good cheer. She preferred to be the observer rather than the focus of everyone's attention. All the questions, when are you due? When will the wedding be? Where will you live? Made her jittery because they hadn't worked out the answers yet. Also, it worried her that she would somehow let people down now. There hadn't been any tears in her mother's violet eyes when she heard about the engagement. Just a lift of her eyebrows before she quickly swept on her most gracious persona, the one where she appeared to channel the queen and completely seduce Patrick with her well-mannered charm. I really couldn't be more thrilled. And a check for $5,000.
Privately, she said to Ellen,
He doesn't need to marry you just because you're pregnant. You've known the man for all of 5 minutes.
He asked me before he knew I was pregnant, said Ellen, and I know everything I need to know about him.
So you think, said Anne under her breath, and Ellen pretended not to hear.
She took a deep breath and rose above it. It was hard to tell exactly what Julia thought about the news. She screamed and hugged Ellen when she heard about the engagement, and said all the right gushy girly things about the ring, but a fleeting shadow crossed her lovely face when she heard about the pregnancy.
What do you mean it was an accident? She said. Teenagers get accidentally pregnant. Were you using mind power as contraception?
Ellen didn't tell her that after her first appointment with the very nice obstetrician recommended by her friend Madeline, she'd worked out that she probably got pregnant after that drunken game of gin rummy when they'd sort of forgotten about contraception. It did make them sound like teenagers.
Have you been out for that drink yet with Stinky? I mean, Sam? Asked Ellen, changing the subject.
He cancelled at the last minute, said Julia shortly. He said he had the flu, couldn't get out of bed.
So he postponed?
Whatever, said Julia.
Don't put on your soft, soothing voice. It drives me nuts. If he's not interested, he's not interested.
Julia, he probably really did have the flu.
Stop it! You've got that condescending, tranquil look on your face.
Ellen gave up and told her instead about Saskia's appearance at Noosa and how it was all Ellen's fault, which cheered Julia up considerably. Patrick's family was lovely. His mother admitted that she'd been praying for an engagement from the very first night she'd met Ellen.
And did you pray for a new baby too? Asked Patrick innocently.
Of course, said Maureen. Admittedly, I didn't think it would happen quite so soon, but if you're thinking I disapprove, Patrick, I'm sorry to disappoint you. I'm not that old-fashioned, she beamed at Ellen. Of course, you will get married before the baby is born, won't you?
Patrick's dad gave her a big fatherly hug, enveloping her in the fragrance of some aftershave that reminded her so strongly of her grandfather, she had to stop herself from clinging on to his shirt front. Patrick's brother, Simon, gave Ellen flowers and cooked them an excellent celebratory dinner. He was a much better cook than Patrick, at his flat. He teased Ellen in a brotherly way she'd never experienced before. She loved it. Ellen had been worried about how Jack would react to the news that she was going to be his stepmother, especially when he heard about the pregnancy, but he seemed perfectly nonchalant about it all.
I hope the baby is a boy, he said. I'll teach him stuff. Like how to drive a car, fly a plane.
He paused and gave Ellen a sidelong look.
Shoot a gun.
Shoot a gun?
Ellen put on her most horrified face.
Just messing with your head, said Jack, delighted. This was his new favorite phrase.
And it seemed that all the logistics were going to work out fine too. Both Patrick and Jack said they were happy to move into Ellen's house.
If you're happy to have us, said Patrick, we'll keep our house as an investment and rent it out. We'll be property tycoons.
I'll go to the beach every single day of my whole life, said Jack, even when it's raining, even when there's hail.
Nah, not really. Just messing with your head.
Jack would still go to the same primary school. The 20-minute drive was of no consequence because Patrick's office was in the same direction. So, that was that. Ellen was part of a new family and her whole life was about to be transformed. She kept wandering through the house, twisting her new engagement ring round and around on her finger, and imagining it filled with new people and new stuff. A room for Jack, a room for the new baby. She would be a mother of two. There would be newsletters from Jack's school on her fridge. Patrick's collection of prints of old surveying equipment would have to go on the wall somewhere. There would be a cot, a change table, a baby's bath. Jack's bike would lie on its side in the front yard. There would be a baby seat in the car, a stroller, and a school bag in the hallway.
It was amazing!
It was absolutely terrifying. Deborah Vandenberg was scheduled for an appointment at 11 a.m. Friday morning. I assume she won't come, said Ellen, now that she knows I know she's Saskia. Although she had said, see you Friday.
I'll have to take the day off work, said Patrick. I don't want you alone with her.
She won't come, said Ellen. But if she does, I'll be fine. She's never been violent.
She didn't want Patrick there. If Saskia did turn up, she wanted to talk to her. She longed to have a proper woman-to-woman chat with her.
"Why do you do this?" she would say. "Help me understand."
Obviously, Ellen could no longer see her on a professional basis, but she could refer her to someone else who could help her both with her leg pain and her inability to let go of Patrick. She would be kind and firm and put an end to all this nonsense. Part of her recognized the folly of her own thinking. If only Saskia saw how very nice and understanding Ellen was, she would graciously step aside.
"This is my problem, not yours," fretted Patrick. "You're pregnant, remember. You should be avoiding stress."
"She won't come," insisted Ellen. "I'm sure she won't come."
"I've got to do something about that restraining order," he said.
Ever since they'd returned from Noosa, he'd been talking about this. But for some reason, Ellen still hadn't managed to identify. He never actually got around to doing it. She was sure it wasn't just about his pride. There was something else behind his procrastination, but she didn't push the issue. From what she'd read, restraining orders didn't offer much protection against truly committed stalkers anyway. In the end, Patrick decided to go to work, because it turned out that Ellen wasn't going to be alone in the house after all. A large plumber would be there replacing the hot water system, which had unexpectedly died the day after they returned from Noosa. The large plumber was a friend of Patrick's, and he promised to stay within earshot the whole time, should Saskia turn up. Although, what if Saskia swiftly removed a gun with a silencer out of her handbag and shot her, or plunged a syringe into her arm that caused total body paralysis, including her vocal cords? Ellen had seen too many horror movies to believe that even the largest plumber could offer any protection from a real psychopath. As the time drew nearer for Saskia's appointment, Ellen sat at her desk and pretended not to care either way. She tried to do some paperwork, but her heart was hammering too hard for her to concentrate. "She won't come," she thought. But actually, she didn't really believe that. At their last session, Ellen had lent Saskia one of her books about hypnosis for pain management. They'd talked about how they both resented people who didn't bother to return books. "Don't worry," Saskia had said. "You'll get it back." The minutes ticked by and the doorbell stayed silent. Was she disappointed or relieved? She felt she could convince herself that either emotion was authentic. At 11:20, the phone rang and Ellen snatched up the receiver.
"Ellen O'Farrell Hypnotherapy, how can I help you?"
There was only the tiniest tremor in her voice. Silence. Ellen thought she could hear the muffled sound of traffic on a busy road.
"Hello?"
she said. Nothing. She pressed the phone hard against her ear. She could definitely hear traffic, a horn tooting. She said quietly, "Saskia?" The line went dead.
"My car broke down on the way to my appointment with Ellen, in the middle lane of the highway. Everyone angrily tooted their horns at me over and over, like their tooting would finally convince me to make my car work again. I got out of the car and screamed at the tooters. Just what do you expect me to do? Do you think I'm doing this on purpose?"
They wouldn't have been able to hear me over the sounds of the traffic. They would have just seen my mouth moving silently and furiously, my arms waving about. "Crazy," the tooting motorists probably muttered to themselves. Yes, indeed. While I waited for the NRMA man to come and rescue me and my car, I decided to call Ellen to let her know that I wasn't going to make it. It felt like the polite, normal thing to do. That's what I would have done for any other appointment. After all, that's what I would have done if I was still Deborah. I had been looking forward to surprising her by turning up as usual for the appointment. I was interested to see how she would handle it. I was wondering if she would even let me in the house. Would she slam the door in my face? I didn't think so. I don't think door slamming is in her sweet, spiritual nature. I suspected that Patrick might be there with her, waiting for me, ready to call the police, ready to finally take out that restraining order he's threatened so often, ready to be protective of his precious, pretty, pregnant fiancée. But if Patrick wasn't there and she did let me in, I was going to admire the ring and ask when the baby was due and if she was planning a big wedding. I was going to ask, did she mind if I wore white too, or would that be offensive? Or was I not on the guest list? Ha ha ha. I was going to ask her if Patrick still liked sex in the shower and Sunday morning blowjobs. I was going to watch that serene expression of hers shatter like broken glass. Or else I wasn't even going to mention Patrick. I was going to continue in my Deborah role and hand back the book she'd lent me and enjoy watching her pretending not to be totally freaking out. I have been watching a lot of television this week, television featuring young American girls. Their language is catching. I was playing it by ear. I could have handled anything, done anything, said anything. That's what I thought anyway. But as soon as I heard her voice on the phone, my own vanished. My vocal cords were paralyzed. It was literally physically impossible for me to say, "Oh, hi, Ellen. It's me, Saskia. I'm not going to make it to my appointment this morning because my car has broken down." I couldn't act like a normal person again when she now knows me as a crazy person, because that would imply I have a choice, that I can choose to be crazy or normal. And if I have a choice, then that would imply that I'm not really crazy at all, and I should just stop it and get on with my life. But what life? Patrick and Ellen are my life. Without them, there's just a job and grocery shopping and a car that needs a new automatic transmission, and that's about it. The doorbell rang that afternoon after the plumber had left, when Ellen was studying the fancy control panel for the new hot water system. Patrick had chosen a system where you could preset the water temperature that came out of the tap. He said it would be perfect for bath time with a new baby. Ellen hadn't even known such systems existed. Also, bath time. She marveled at his casual reference to something so ordinary and yet extraordinary. He'd put together a long list of things that needed doing around the house to prepare for the baby. The PowerPoints had to be childproofed. The spiral staircase was a death trap for toddlers, and so on and so forth. So I guess we'll have to get quotes. Ellen's stress levels had risen as she looked at the list. "I'll take care of all that," said Patrick. He puffed his chest out and jutted his jaw like a superhero. "Don't you worry your pretty little head about it." She put a hand to her forehead and pretended to swoon in his arms. Actually, it was almost a genuine swoon. Ellen looked at the time. She wasn't expecting any clients. "Saskia," she thought as she walked down the stairs. "And now there's no large plumber to protect me." Just in case, she picked up one of her grandmother's heavy glass candlestick holders from the hall table, laughing at her serious reflection in the hallway mirror. But still, she didn't put it down. She opened the door. It wasn't Saskia. It was a thin, short, nervous-looking girl smoking a cigarette and smiling up at her apologetically. Ellen knew her face perfectly well, but for a moment she couldn't place her. She'd been so sure it was Saskia, she couldn't get the name Saskia out of her head. The girl dropped the cigarette and crushed it beneath her foot. Then she picked up the butt and held it in her cupped hand. "I can't believe I lit this up while I was waiting for you," she said. "I'm an idiot. Anyway, as you can see, I'm still at it." Ellen stared at the crushed cigarette and said, "Rosie." "Yes," said Rosie. "I'm sorry. I know I don't have an appointment. I just got back from my honeymoon this morning, and I came by on the off chance you had some free time." "I saw your wedding photos in the paper last week," said Ellen, trying not to sound resentful. "You still married him after our breakthrough. Why did you marry him if you knew you didn't even like him?" "Those photos were awful," said Rosie. "I look so ugly. And you saw the color of the bridesmaids' dresses?" "The pictures were black and white." "Ah, right, of course. Well, they were awful. Anyway, could you fit me in?" "Of course I could," said Ellen warmly, guilty about her resentment. She stood back and ushered her in, discreetly replacing the candlestick holder on the table. "You're probably wondering why I still married him," said Rosie when she was settled in the green recliner. "Here," said Ellen, offering a tissue in the flat of her hand so that Rosie could finally dispose of the cigarette butt she was still holding. "It was the most stupid of all reasons," said Rosie. "You'll be horrified." "I'm sure I won't be, although she might very well be." "When I left here after our last session, I was so ready to call off the wedding. I knew it would be a huge deal. The invitations had gone out. You know the Prime Minister was on the guest list. She had to be in Japan or something, but, you know. And my mum had lost 20 kilos and bought the most expensive dress she'd ever owned. And my dad had spent days working on this terrible speech. And my friends were all so jealous, which isn't the reason to marry somebody. But, you know, everyone thought I was marrying out of my league, which I was. Which I did. But anyway, that's not why I did it. It was something that happened after I left here.
What happened? Asked Ellen.
I thought I'd go for a walk on the beach, said Rosie.
She was tapping at her lips with two fingertips in a V-shape, the way of a smoker longing for a cigarette.
To clear my head, to think about how I could possibly explain it to Ian, and I saw this couple sitting on the beach and they were kissing, really kissing. You know the way people kiss when they're at the beginning of a relationship?
I know, said Ellen. She remembered that kiss with Patrick outside the museum.
And I thought, oh, that's sweet. But then as I got closer, I thought, that's Joe, my ex-boyfriend. We broke up a year ago. I thought I was over him. I thought I didn't care less. But the way he was kissing this girl, like he had never experienced such bliss, it just killed me.
Ah, said Ellen.
And just like that, I thought, I can't do it. I can't call off the wedding, said Rosie. We were going on our honeymoon to this expensive resort in Malaysia where my ex-boyfriend and I had always wanted to go, but we couldn't ever afford it. And I wanted him to hear about it. I wanted him to imagine me there with another man. I wanted to wipe that blissful expression off his face. He'd always had a thing about money and wealthy people being somehow better than him, and I knew that we had mutual friends who would tell him all about the wedding. And I don't know. It was like I lost my mind. And I just went ahead with the wedding and decided that I did love Ian. Of course I did. How could I not? I convinced myself that I just got confused in my session. I sort of blamed you, to be honest. So I got married, and that was all fine. But you know what?
What? Said Ellen.
Two things. The resort in Malaysia wasn't that great. It was actually pretty awful. And we had to cut the honeymoon short because of some merger or coup or something or other. And then, do you know what I heard this morning? My ex only went out with that girl for a few weeks. He's single again. But I actually couldn't care less either way. I never really wanted to get back together with him. I just couldn't bear to think of him being so happy with someone else and then hearing that I was single again. Isn't that the most pathetic thing you've ever heard in your life?
Of course not, said Ellen. We all have the most peculiar motivations for what we do. There was a pause. Rosie fidgeted and then said suddenly,
You're engaged!
She pointed at Ellen's ring and Ellen realized she'd been drawing attention to it by twisting it around her finger. It had very quickly become a habit.
Congratulations! I bet you love him. I bet you love him properly.
Well, Ellen smiled foolishly. She didn't want to sound smug.
Anyway, said Rosie, Ian wants to try for a baby straight away.
So you're ready to give up smoking once and for all? Guessed Ellen.
No, said Rosie. I want you to hypnotize me into falling in love with him. I mean, love is just a state of mind, right? I don't want to have a baby with someone I don't love. You can do that, right? Make me believe that I love him, so I haven't made the worst mistake of my life?
Chapter 13. A woman's relationship with her father will have a profound impact on all her future relationships with men. The fatherless daughter lacks a template. Fatherless daughters are more likely to be promiscuous.
So great. Thanks, Mum. I'm going to be a slut.
Entry in Ellen O'Farrell's diary, written a week before her 15th birthday. Ellen's mother was nervous. It was suddenly perfectly clear. Ever since they'd arrived at the restaurant for lunch, Ellen had been observing Anne, trying to work out what was different about her. Anyone else would have said that Anne was calm and at ease as she chatted with Ellen about the pregnancy, argued amiably with Ellen's godmothers about the choice of wine, and asked the waiter probing questions about the specials. Yet there was something odd about the way she was sitting. Her back was unnaturally straight. Even for someone who was a passionate advocate of good posture. Her chin too high, her shoulders too braced. Her beautiful violet eyes kept sweeping past Ellen.
Normally, Ellen was aware of her mother's eyes giving her a rigorous health check, monitoring her skin tone, her weight, the whites of her eyes. She had always thought that Anne would have preferred to strap a blood pressure monitor around her arm and shove a thermometer in her mouth each time they met rather than hug her. She turned her attention to her godmothers. Philippa had an air of suppressed excitement, as if she was about to see a slightly risque show. At first, she couldn't see anything out of the ordinary about Melanie. But then she saw the way her eyes kept returning to Anne, waiting for something. Ellen remembered Mel's phone call, only 2 weeks ago now, when she'd said that Anne was behaving oddly. With the pregnancy and the engagement, she'd forgotten all about it. As soon as the waiter left after taking their orders, Ellen spoke up. "Okay, what's going on?" Anne's hand went straight to her neck, and Ellen saw that she was wearing a beautiful, expensive-looking necklace that Ellen had never seen before, and also that the skin of her neck seemed older and more vulnerable than the rest of her, like a crumpled piece of silk. Ellen wanted to reach out and smooth it.
"Where did you get that necklace?" asked Ellen.
"You really can't put anything past this one," said Philippa proudly. "She's always been like that. Remember that time we tried to convince her that..."
"Pip," said Melanie. "This is between Anne and Ellen."
"Exactly. I agree. I don't even know why we're here. Would you like us to go off somewhere and give you two some privacy?"
Anne sighed. "The three of us brought up Ellen together. That's why I wanted you two here as well. You've both been like mothers to Ellen. The four of us are a family. We're a family, and this is a family matter."
Ellen was horrified. Her mother did not talk like this.
"It's cancer, isn't it?" she said.
"It's good news,"
Anne smiled. Suddenly she looked radiant. "I came around to tell you the other night, actually, but then we got distracted, didn't we?"
"Okay," said Ellen. "Well, it's just that I've met up with your father, that's all."
"Well, not quite all," said Philippa.
"I'm sort of in a relationship with him," said Anne.
"It's so romantic," sighed Philippa.
"I don't understand," said Ellen. "I thought he was married and living in the UK."
"Divorced," said Anne blissfully, as if divorced was one of life's sweetest pleasures.
"And he's moved back to Sydney," added Melanie. "Your mother has been seeing him for weeks. She never told us. I knew something was going on."
"It's all due to me," said Philippa. "He found me on Facebook. He asked if I kept in touch with Anne O'Farrell, and when I told your mother, I could tell by the expression on her face that she still had a thing for him, even after all these years."
"A thing for him?" said Ellen. She could feel the most profound sense of irritation rising in her chest. The three of them were acting like teenagers.
"But you picked him from a list."
"Yes, yes, all that happened," said Anne. "Don't worry, your life isn't based on a lie. The part I didn't ever tell you was that I did actually have a little crush on him."
"More than a little," said Melanie. "Pip and I saw right through her, of course."
Now all three of them were chewing at their expensively lipsticked mouths, like schoolgirls trying not to giggle in class. Anne refilled their wine glasses, and Ellen, who was drinking mineral water, felt like their middle-aged mother. They were all being so silly.
"And it turns out that he's always had a thing for me too," said Anne with pride. "He thought about me throughout his marriage. I was always popping up in his dreams, apparently."
"That poor woman," said Ellen.
"What poor woman?" her mother frowned.
"His wife. The one he was engaged to when you slept with him to conceive me."
"Oh, don't be so."
Anne stopped and flicked her hand as if to wave away a harmless insect. Ellen suspected she'd been about to say boring. Mel spoke up.
"Ellen, your mother had nothing to do with their marriage breakdown. There's nothing untoward going on here."
Ellen thought about some poor woman in London sleeping next to her husband each night while he dreamed of a violet-eyed girl back in sunny Sydney. Nothing untoward, indeed.
"So," Ellen tried not to sound snappish, "you've told him about me?"
Anne's moony expression vanished and she looked nervous again.
"He was very shocked, of course, and so cross at me for not telling him. He said he would have called off the wedding if he'd known and married me. Imagine!
I could have been quite the little housewife.
Oh, Mum, said Ellen. There was something cozy and self-satisfied about her mother's tone. It made Ellen's whole existence seem tacky and trite instead of bohemian and brave.
You'll meet him, of course, won't you, Ellen? Said Philippa. It'll be just like that television show where they reunite lost families. I'm crying already just thinking about it.
I will meet him, of course I'll meet him. But there's nothing romantic or heart-wrenching about this, said Ellen. We just share the same DNA.
But now you know your parents were in love.
We thought you'd be thrilled. Mel gave Ellen a curious, analytical frown, as though she were an accounting discrepancy she needed to solve. You were always so desperate to meet your father. You were obsessed with him for a while.
When I was 15, said Ellen, now it just seemed like an awkward sort of social obligation.
Don't you want to see what he's like? Asked Philippa.
I'm curious, I guess, continued Ellen, except she wasn't particularly. She was too focused on her own life at the moment. Her baby, her soon-to-be stepson and husband, her husband-to-be's ex-girlfriend. She didn't have time to devote to building a new relationship.
Well, there's no rush, said Anne. Whenever you're ready.
Her hand kept returning to her neck to caress the stone of her new necklace.
So the necklace is a gift from him? Asked Ellen. From, David? Surely she wasn't meant to call him Dad.
Anne removed her hand.
Yes, it's for our one-month anniversary, she flushed. I know we're too old for that sort of thing.
Aw, said Philippa. Ellen's mother was clearly in love, and she was in love with Ellen's father, which in most cases was considered appropriate and convenient, and the way the world was meant to work. Ellen couldn't understand why she felt so unhappy about it. Was it just resistance to change? Did she not want her mother to love anyone else except her? She would have to think about this when she got home.
I'm happy for you, Mum. She did her utmost to sound sincere.
I'm not counting my chickens. It's early days, of course, said Anne briskly, but then she smiled her bizarre new smile and reached out to touch Ellen's hand.
Your dad is the loveliest man I've ever known.
I live in a 3-bedroom duplex. I've never been very fond of duplexes, and yet, here I am. When Patrick and I broke up, I needed somewhere new to live, fast. And I asked a real estate agent I knew to find me the first available rental property in my price range. So he found me this bland, sterile little place in a street crammed with identical duplexes and 3 20-story apartment blocks. The people who live here are hard-working, mid-level professionals. They are the worker bees of society on their way to something better. This is an area where convenience is what counts. The railway station is an easy walk, and it's only a 10-minute trip into the city. There are dozens of perfectly adequate but not that great restaurants, and 24-hour dry cleaners and ATMs and cab ranks. People stride along checking their Blackberries and gulping down takeaway coffees. It's not a place for lovers. There are no buskers or bookshops or galleries or cinemas. It's good. It's like an extension of the office. Ever since I moved in, a man named Jeff has lived in the other half of my duplex. He is short and bald with a neat ginger-colored beard, and the most personal fact I know about him is that he doesn't feel the cold. He wears short-sleeved shirts all year round. When he's inside, I rarely hear a sound from him through our shared walls. No music, no television. Once I did hear him crying out as if in anguish,
"But that's not the way you do it!"
Do what? But I was only mildly intrigued. I didn't care enough to actually have a proper conversation or make eye contact with him. If we see each other at the letterbox or walking in and out of our front doors, we both immediately speed up and walk away fast like we have suddenly remembered we're running very late, or we develop an intense interest in one of the letters we have just received, tearing it open as if it's of the utmost importance. We call out things in a distracted, busy tone like, "Hot, isn't it?" and "Cold, isn't it?" Or if the weather is difficult to label, "How are you?" And we never wait for the other person to answer because we don't care about the answer. Sometimes in my head I answer, "Still obsessively stalking my ex-boyfriend, grieving for my dead mother, and suffering unexplained leg pain, thanks. How about you?" So yes, Jeff is the perfect neighbor for a duplex. We have managed to live next door all these years and collect each other's mail when one of us is away and negotiate shared issues about garbage collection and lawn mowing while maintaining the most delightfully superficial of relationships. And then today, when I just got home from collecting the car from the mechanic, Jeff suddenly marched up to me and stood far too close. I tried to take a discreet step backward. "Hi, Saskia," he said. I think this was the first time he'd ever used my name. "Hi, Jeff," I said. "Likewise." "I wanted to let you know that I'm moving," he said. "I'm having a sea change."
"Sea change?" I repeated.
"Yes, I'm moving to a little town down the south coast. I'm going to run a cafe. I'm calling it Jeff's Jetty Cafe."
I was stunned, not sure why. I think I just never expected him to be important enough to make any significant changes in his life. But of course, he doesn't know that he's only a minor character in my life. He's the star of his own life, and I'm the minor character. And fair enough, too.
"It's not on a jetty, but I'm going to give it a jetty sort of look. Ropes and anchors and buckets, that sort of stuff."
A flash of uncertainty crossed his face. He has no idea what he's doing.
"Sounds wonderful," I said. "It will be a spectacular failure."
"Yeah, decided it was time to get out of the police force," he said.
"You're a policeman?"
I couldn't believe it. I'd never seen him in a uniform. I thought he was an auditor or an IT consultant or even a librarian.
Shouldn't policemen be forced to disclose their careers to their neighbors? What if I'd casually revealed a crime to him at the letterbox, offered him an illegal substance? And there is the matter of Patrick. He's always threatening to call the police. So melodramatic. Why would the police be interested in what is essentially a private matter between two adults? But still, technically, I do enter his house without his permission.
"I had no idea you were a policeman," I said. I couldn't keep the resentment out of my voice.
"Undercover," said Jeff. "Pretty stressful. Messes with your head. Impossible to form a relationship with anyone. I'm not getting any younger. I'm desperate to meet that special lady. Want to be a dad one day."
I did not want to hear that Jeff was desperate to meet that special lady. It was like he'd shared an intimate, slightly revolting sexual secret.
"A nice young family is moving into my place," he continued. "Two little kids, boy and girl. You'll find them a bit livelier than me."
And that suddenly seemed to remind him of the sort of neighbors we'd been, and he took an abrupt step backward.
"So," he said, "I've kept you long enough. Just thought I should let you know so you didn't get a surprise when the movers arrive tomorrow. The young family will be moving in the day after."
"Best of luck with everything," I said.
"Thanks," he said, and smiled. He had an unexpectedly nice, shy smile, and I was filled with a strange, sad regret. I could have been his friend. I could have invited him over for a drink or a coffee. Maybe then he wouldn't have needed his silly sea change. Before Patrick, I would have been the sort of person who would have done that. This is all Patrick's fault. And now there will be a nice young family living next door. My bland little duplex will no longer be my safe haven from other people's happiness. The thought of having to hear and see this smug family loving each other every day of my life is unbearable and unacceptable. I hate families with one boy and one girl, like a family in a car commercial. It's so tidy. They're always so pleased with themselves. I can feel this explosive pressure building in my head. Something has to happen. I have to make something happen. Soon. I'm just not sure what. When Ellen got home from lunch with her mother and godmothers, she sat on the front step with her bag on her lap. She didn't want to take the keys out of her bag and open the door to an empty house. She wanted to ring the bell and wait for the sound of slow, shuffling footsteps. Her grandfather always opened the door with a wary, almost belligerent expression on his face that would vanish when he saw it was her. "She's here!" he'd call out jubilantly to her grandmother, and he'd open the door wide and Ellen would smell baking. They'd been dead for over a year, but today for some reason it didn't seem possible that they weren't inside. They must have opened that door to her hundreds of times. It didn't feel like she was just recalling memories. It seemed perfectly reasonable that they were still there, somewhere, on some other plane of existence.
and if she just sat here quietly for long enough and really concentrated, she could slip through time or matter or something and rest her head on her grandfather's shoulder just one more time and see him redden slightly the way he always did whenever she hugged him.
"What's on your mind, Ellie?"
Her grandmother was the only one who had ever called her Ellie.
"I did not and never would have named my child Ellie," Anne would shudder.
She longed to tell her grandparents about this new development in her life, that David Greenfield, that strange, enticing name on her birth certificate, was no longer the carefully selected sperm donor of her youth, but the loveliest man her mother had ever known. It was like hearing that Santa Claus really did exist after all when you no longer cared or believed in the possibility of magic, when it was just plain confusing.
"That mother of yours," her grandmother would shake her head and put the kettle on again.
Ellen sighed and smiled.
"Yes, that's what this was really all about. She wanted her mother reprimanded for creating this upheaval in her life."
Her grandparents were always on her side.
And the reason she wanted her mother reprimanded was just fear. Fear of change. Fear of the unknown. The same fear that caused her grandfather to look wary when he opened the door.
"Is that change knocking on my door?"
She sighed, took her keys out of her bag and stood up. Her eye was caught by something on the wrought iron mosaic table near the front door. Her grandmother had made that table after she'd done a mosaics course. It wasn't actually very good. The green and orange rectangles were all out of alignment. Apparently the teacher had kept scolding her grandmother for talking too much during class. A book had been placed upright in the center of the table, carefully displayed like it was for sale in a bookshop. There was a pink camellia flower lying diagonally next to it. An icy thumb caressed Ellen's spine. It was the book she'd lent Saskia. She'd returned it, as promised. Ellen picked up the book and flipped through the pages. No note. Just the creepy, careful way it was displayed. And the flower. What did the flower mean?
"Is this the hypnotherapy place?"
A voice interrupted her thoughts. Ellen jumped and gave a startled, girly shriek.
"Oh, I'm so sorry to frighten you like that."
A man in his late 40s or early 50s, with a humble, apologetic look on his face, stood at the bottom of the porch stairs looking up at her. He was carrying a notebook with a pen carefully clipped to the side, and wearing a business shirt that appeared two sizes too big for him, without a tie. He looked like a man running late for his new Bible study group. Ellen pressed her hand to her chest to calm her thumping heart.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I was just very deep in thought."
She smiled and held out her hand as she walked down the steps to meet him. "This is definitely the right place. You're Alfred, right?"
"Alfred Boyle.
I'm Ellen." Alfred was a new client who had found her on the internet and emailed a few weeks back to ask for written confirmation of her pricing. He'd said in his email that he was a partner in an accounting firm and that he required help improving his public speaking skills in a professional setting. As Ellen opened the front door for him and led him up the stairs, she glanced around, hoping for a fleeting glimpse of her grandparents. What would they have to say about Saskia? But the house was empty, and no matter how hard she sniffed, hoping for the scents of her grandmother's baking, all she could smell was a Thai chicken curry she'd made the night before. She left the book and the camellia flower on the hall table to think about later. Chapter 14. Freud always said that the reason he stopped using hypnosis was that a patient jumped up and kissed him. Apparently, the real reason was that his false teeth no longer fitted properly after his gums had been ruined by his cocaine use, and he couldn't speak well enough to easily induce trances. The lesson for us? Floss. Excerpt from a speech delivered by Flynn Halliday to the Northern Beaches Hypnotherapists Meeting, August 2010.
"Ellen, my dear, you are looking well."
"Thank you, Flynn." Flynn Halliday bent to brush his cheek against hers. It was a month since Ellen had returned from Noosa, and she was attending the regular local chapter meeting of the Australian Association of Hypnotherapists. Flynn was president and Ellen was treasurer. They ran the meetings in a small room at a local community centre, and Flynn and Ellen had arrived half an hour early to set up the room.
"How have you been?"
asked Flynn as they dragged tables and chairs into a horseshoe shape. Any news?
Ellen hesitated. She was feeling guilty. She always felt guilty around Flynn because she felt like she'd let him down in many ways. She'd known him since she was in her early 20s. He'd employed her for many years in his hypnotherapy business as an assistant, a trainee therapist, and finally a hypnotherapist. He'd wanted her to go into partnership with him, and she knew he'd been very hurt when she decided to go out on her own. There was also that thing she'd never spoken out loud, or even properly admitted to herself. The thing about the way Flynn looked at her. Sometimes she thought she was imagining it, and she was behaving like a typical fatherless daughter, by misinterpreting the perfectly acceptable fondness of an older man for a younger colleague. Other times she was quite sure that if she'd ever given Flint the slightest encouragement, he most certainly would have courted her. With poetry, probably, elaborate compliments and thoughtful gifts. Flynn, who had never married or even been in a relationship as far as Ellen knew, was in his late 50s, with fine, fair hair and a rosy, cherubic face. He looked like an elderly choir boy. The idea of sex with Flynn seemed illegal. There was no need to mention the pregnancy yet, although over the last few weeks she had begun to feel profoundly different. Strange little poking sensations in her belly, tender breasts, mild nausea that lasted all day long, and a permanent sense of quivering on the verge of tears. She looked exactly the same way, and anyway, she thought that Flynn would prefer to think of her as a virgin. But it would be strange not to mention the engagement. "I do have some news, actually," she said, pressing her thumb to her ring. "I'm engaged." Flynn had been facing away from her. He waited just a beat too long to turn around. Ellen's eyes filled. "Oh, Flynn, you silly man. If only it was possible to live a parallel life, a spare one, where she could have let Flynn court her and marry her, and she could have made him happy, except without the sex."
"Congratulations!"
Flynn came across the room and gave her a clumsy, vaguely peppermint-scented kiss. He stood back and clasped his hands together like a country vicar.
"Wonderful."
As Flynn groped about for something else to say, Ellen thought about Saskia. If only her relationship with Flynn wasn't so complicated, she would have asked his advice. She had a lot of respect for his opinions when it came to the human psyche. Ellen wished she'd never told Patrick about Saskia returning the book. He'd been battling insomnia ever since, pacing the house, frustrated with his own powerlessness. "I hate that you have to deal with this," he'd said. His face looked older, weighed down with stress. "I'm meant to make your life better, not harder."
"She just returned a book," said Ellen. "I'm not frightened." She wasn't. Not really. Only a mild, fluttery sense of unease that could have just been a natural reaction to all the changes going on in her life. Nothing to do with Saskia at all.
"So, that's just wonderful news," said Flynn again. Then an expression of panic flew across his face.
"It's not that Danny fellow, is it?" he said.
"No, I'm marrying a surveyor, actually," said Ellen. "I shall be a surveyor's wife."
"What?"
The oddest things came out of her mouth when she was feeling awkward.
"Surveyor, man of the land. Right, wonderful."
Flynn kept his hands clasped and shook them as if he was giving himself a warm handshake.
"Yes, yes, because that Danny, have you heard what he's doing?"
Danny and Flynn had been introduced only once by Ellen at an industry function, and there had been an instant mutual dislike.
"I haven't talked to him for a while." "He's treating hypnotherapy like Tupperware. He's running these parties, and he's calling them hypno-parties."
Marlene Adams sailed into the room. She was another hypnotherapist of a similar generation and mindset to Flynn. Why hadn't he fallen for her?
"Isn't it dreadful? I heard him talking on the radio just yesterday, and I thought to myself, what? I beg your pardon? Hypno-parties? Well, that's just going to do wonders for our professional credibility, isn't it?"
"So next Sunday is the last Sunday of the month," said Patrick, later that afternoon.
"Old jeans," said Ellen. "This box says old jeans." She had stopped in the hallway to look at the neatly written notation in black marker on a large dusty cardboard box. Patrick and Jack had been officially living at her place now for just a week,
However, the process of moving in their possessions was proving to be complex. Apparently, Patrick didn't believe in movers. They were overpaid thugs. Instead, every couple of days, whenever he got a chance, he picked up a few boxes in the back of his company pickup truck and dropped them off. Ellen would have preferred that he take a few days off work and hire some overpaid thugs to do the job properly. Instead, her hallway was rapidly filling with giant cardboard boxes, which Patrick didn't have time to move and which were too heavy for Ellen to lift. Her clients had to shuffle sideways every time they walked through her hallway. Does that mean this cardboard box is filled with old jeans?
Is that a trick question? Asked Patrick.
Why do you keep old jeans?
For doing stuff around the house, working in the garden, that sort of thing, said Patrick in a patient, manly tone.
Okay, but a whole box of them? Ellen ran a fingertip over the layer of dust on the box. She had a feeling this box had been sitting in Patrick's garage for years. These jeans would never be used, and he would never throw them out. Her nose tickled, and she sneezed.
Bless you, said Patrick. So, as I was saying, it's the last Sunday of the month.
She looked at the next box. It said, old shirts. She could smell a damp, moldy smell. Actually, she could see a patch of furry green mold growing on the side of the box. He was a hoarder. She hadn't known this about him. His house had looked perfectly acceptable when she visited. Very tidy and organized, in fact. All of these boxes must have been crammed behind cupboard doors and stacked up to the ceiling in his garage. Her throat tickled and she sneezed again.
How many more boxes do you think he'll be bringing over?
She asked, trying to make it sound like she was just casually interested.
I'll barely scratch the surface, said Patrick cheerfully. We've been in that house for over 20 years. Collected a lot of stuff.
Ellen felt a rising sense of hysteria.
Why? Is it bugging you?
Obviously, this is only temporary. I'm not planning on using your hallway as a permanent storage area, if that's what you're thinking. He put his hand on her waist.
You should have driven a lot of this stuff straight to the rubbish tip from your place, said Ellen and moved slightly so that his hand fell away. You would never have missed it.
She recognized that cool, precise voice. It was her mother's voice. Just recently, Julia had said she'd found herself speaking more and more like her own mother, and Ellen had said, "There's no danger of that happening to me." Anne had a violent dislike of stuff. She always spat out the word stuff like a profanity. Ellen's possessions were always disappearing when she was a child. "You hadn't touched that stuff in weeks," her mother would say when Ellen discovered some toy or piece of clothing had been donated to the poor people. Ellen had always felt envious when she visited friends and saw their kitchen benchtops laden with the detritus of their chaotic family lives, the framed photos on bookshelves overflowing with books, the strawberry-shaped magnets holding up school merit awards and colorful drawings on the refrigerator. Her home, and therefore her life, seemed so sterile in comparison. She equated messiness with love and warmth, and those sweet, vague, plump mothers who distractedly offered her peanut butter sandwiches before hurrying back to the stove or the laundry. On the rare occasions when Anne wasn't at work and Ellen's friends visited, her mother would take far too much notice of them, skewering them with her violet eyes, offering lime juice. What kid drinks lime juice? Asking their opinions on current affairs. They didn't have any opinions, of course, except Julia, who thought Ellen's mother was fabulous, and then making sarcastic little jokes they didn't understand. Ellen couldn't believe that she'd just used the word stuff in the same context as her mother. It just goes to show how your childhood experiences are imprinted on your subconscious. When she found the time, she would need to do some serious work on this and delve into her true feelings on the matter, or otherwise she'd find herself offering lime juice to her child's friends one day.
It is bugging you, said Patrick. Look, I promise it will all be gone by the weekend.
He looked so sweet and apologetic that Ellen felt a rush of love for him and her eyes filled with guilty tears. Pregnancy hormones. It was quite fascinating observing their impact on her emotions. That's fine, there's no rush, I'm just being silly. She blinked rapidly and continued down the hallway without looking at the boxes. What were you saying about Sunday? They went into the kitchen and Patrick put the kettle on. He always put the kettle on the moment they walked into the kitchen, taking it for granted that they would be having a cup of tea. There was something old-fashioned and ceremonial about it, and it reminded her of someone.
Who?
Of course, it was her grandfather. Her lovely grandfather making tea for her grandmother. Yes, she did adore Patrick. Thank God. She knew it was silly and unrealistic, but she felt panicky whenever she experienced even a moment's irritation with him. They were having a baby together. She had to remain vigilant. Any cracks in their relationship had to be patched up immediately. It was absolutely vital. This child, her child, was going to grow up with a mother and a father.
So what were you saying about this Sunday?
She said again as Patrick placed the cup of tea in front of her. This Sunday she was meeting her father for the first time. Her stomach clenched on cue as the thought crossed her mind. It was impossible to pretend that she didn't care or that she wasn't nervous. Her body gave it away every time she thought about it.
It's the last Sunday of the month, said Patrick. He turned away to the refrigerator.
Have we got any crumpets? He spoke with his back to her as he burrowed through her refrigerator shelves.
Oh, good. Here they are.
So, I wondered if you'd like to come along with us.
Wholemeal?
Why ruin a good crumpet by making it wholemeal?
What are you talking about? Said Ellen. He was going to eat all the crumpets now and she wouldn't have any for her morning tea tomorrow. Also, he wasn't making any sense.
Why do you keep saying the last Sunday of the month like it means something to me?
Patrick looked up with surprise as he put the last two crumpets into her toaster. You know, on the last Sunday of the month, Jack and I always visit Colleen's parents for lunch in the mountains.
You still visit Colleen's parents? Said Ellen confusedly.
Every month?
They're Jack's grandparents, said Patrick. We always stop at Colleen's grave along the way.
You have never told me that before, said Ellen. She was aware that her heart rate was up, just slightly.
Never.
I'm sorry, I thought I had, said Patrick. Anyway, doesn't matter.
You've never mentioned it, said Ellen. There is no way in the world that she would forget something like that. She was a woman. She was Ellen. She might have forgotten what model car he drove or what football team he followed, but she would not have forgotten that he visited his dead wife's grave and family every month.
It doesn't matter, began Patrick again.
It does matter, said Ellen. You've never mentioned this before.
I know. I would have remembered.
I didn't say I had mentioned it. I thought I had mentioned it, said Patrick.
Obviously I didn't, but it really...
When? Said Ellen. When did you think you had mentioned it?
The crumpets popped up. Patrick went to lift them from the toaster and burned the tip of his fingers.
Ow! Look, I don't know. I genuinely thought I had.
You didn't.
Ellen knew she was being horrible.
Fine. I forgot to mention it. I'm sorry. Can we let it go now?
I can't stand it when you say that, said Ellen, and it immediately struck her that he'd never said it before. It was Edward who used to say that. Can we just let it go? He'd say in that exact same exhausted tone. It was amazing how that long-lost memory had somehow floated to the surface of her consciousness after all this time.
You can't stand it when I say what?
Patrick looked taken aback.
Nothing, said Ellen. Sorry.
She wondered if he'd deliberately or subconsciously avoided mentioning Colleen too much before they were engaged. She'd noticed that ever since she'd accepted his proposal, her name had been cropping up more often. Just the other day, he'd walked by the laundry when she was putting in the laundry powder and commented that Colleen had always said it was a good idea to put the laundry powder into the machine before the clothes so that it was fully dissolved or something. She felt a tremor of irritation. It seemed that Colleen had been something of a domestic goddess. She also sewed. One of the boxes in the hallway said, sewing machine.
Colleen made her own wedding dress on that machine, Patrick had said when Ellen asked him about it.
Well, I won't be making my own dress, Ellen had said lightly. I can't even thread a needle.
And Patrick had said, oh no, I wouldn't expect you to.
Which had somehow made Ellen feel he was really saying, of course I wouldn't expect you to ever be as extraordinary as Colleen.
Bloody, beautiful, blonde-haired, laundry-powder-dissolving Colleen.
So anyway, I thought now that we're engaged and with the baby and everything, Patrick cleared his throat and didn't quite look at her. I thought maybe you could come along and meet them this Sunday.
Ellen took a deep, soothing breath. This was important to him. He was nervous about asking her.
Well, that would be nice, but I can't this Sunday, she said. I'm having lunch with Mum and with my father. I'm meeting him for the first time, remember? Patrick had been excited about the sudden appearance in Ellen's life of a father. They'd talked about it at length, wondering together what he would be like. Would there be a resemblance to Ellen? Wondering how he must be feeling, the strangeness of it, the awkwardness of it, the weirdness of Anne's behavior. Oh, of course, said Patrick, now frowning as he buttered the crumpets with far too much butter. I'd forgotten. Could you change that, do you think? Meet him for dinner instead? She didn't want to change it to dinner. Dinner was more intimate, more formal,